A song through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing. A new love affair, then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Hasper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Debunking the idiocy of coincidence theorists with me, Robert Larson, on Out the Rabbit Hole, Fridays, 3 to 4 p.m., KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
Get the lowdown on the publishing industry. Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KUCI FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello again, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org, and we podcast as well. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. Today, my guests are Walter Mosley and Kirk Snyder. First up is Walter Mosley. He's the author of more than a couple of dozen novels, nonfiction books, essays, so very much. His first E.Z. Rollins' novel was Devil in a Blue Dress that was made into a film starring Denzel Washington. And he's here tonight to talk about This Year You Write Your Novel. Little Brown published it. Hi, Walter.
Hello.
Great to have you on the show. And I was so happy when this book was flung at my door by the UPS man. I had no idea you had even written it until it hit my doorstep. And I love this book. I just love it. I love the voice. It's the voice that is you, that characterizes your E.Z. Rollins fiction and essays I've written by you. Will you talk a bit about how the book came about?
Well, you know, whenever I go around doing readings, which is more often than I'd like, actually, people ask me questions about writing. And I found myself giving kind of like a pat answer. I'd say, well, you know, I only have like 10 minutes. If I had an hour, I could tell you everything I know. But I only have, you know, 10 minutes, so I'll tell you, you know, this little thing. And I thought about that, and I realized it was true that, you know, a book about writing a novel, everything I read about, I know about writing a novel, is, you know, really not that much, that long. It's complex a little bit in places, but not that much, really. And so I thought, well, let me see if I could write this book. And, you know, it was my goal to write it in under 100 pages, which I did. And it's everything I know about writing a novel in a very kind of pedestrian and pragmatic form, you know, not, you know, kind of getting off into the ether of, you know, great literature or, you know, kind of mystical, magical things. And just writing, this is how you write a book. This is what you have to do in order to write a book. This is what you need to know in order to write a book. This is how you come back at it and rewrite it.
Mm. One thing I do love about it is that while it is full of the practical information, again, it's in your voice. And that to me is one of the compelling aspects. And the other is that it is so short. You know, there's so many books out on how to write a novel and trying to motivate you to write a novel. And so many of them are so long that you could spend all of your writing time reading the book instead of writing.
Very long about it, and of course, it's as far as I can tell, wholly unnecessary. You know, there's all of this talk. Another problem that other books that I've read that, you know, because I mean, it was because I was criticizing the books that existed that I wrote this book. I mean, if I thought this book had already existed, I wouldn't have written it. Another problem I found is that people start to compare, you know, the kind of fledgling writers writing to great writers. You know, so he's talking about Flannery O'Connor and Isaac Babel and, you know, and all these people who are, like, so great. And I think, well, really, you know, let's just talk about this simple putting together of sentences in order to tell a story, because that's really the big thing about writing novels. How do you tell the story? Mm-hmm. Another problem I found in these kind of bigger, longer books is a lot of attention being paid to, you know, what is called great writing. And, of course, I think that's problematic.
Mm-hmm. One thing you stress in the book is how it's really important to write every day.
Yes, the most important thing about writing is that you write every day. If you write every day, you've, like, done 50% of what you need to do to write a book. And if you don't write every day, you aren't doing 100% of what you need to do to write a book.
Mm-hmm. Can you go a little bit more into that? Because a couple years ago, there was a collection that came out that's still in print called Writers on Writing, Collected Essays from the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
You have a wonderful essay in that book called For Authors, Fragile Ideas Need Loving Every Day. And you talk about how even if you don't necessarily write, you at least visit with what you've written and what you're working on.
Well, you know, I think that every day at probably the same time, I mean, if you can't do it at the same time, I guess no, but at hopefully the same time, you sit down to your book. And either, you know, you go over what you wrote yesterday, you start writing some new ideas that you have on the book, or you just think about the book. You just kind of sit with it for an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours. That's enough to bring you into the dream of the novel. And I think that, for me, the dream of a novel is it's really your unconscious. I don't really know how to, you know, I don't want to sound too highfalutin when I say that, but it's just that a part of your mind works on the novel that you're not aware of, and that part of your mind is an unconscious part of your mind. If you go to the novel every day, the rest of the day will be spent your mind considering issues and parts of that novel. That's the most important reason to write every day, other than the fact that, you know, you have to get the work done. And if you do that, if you come to your book every day, the novel will happen. Because, you know, once you read my book, it's not that if you've read the book and then you could turn to somebody else and say, well, here's how you write a novel, you would know. But if you read the book and then follow what it says, over a period of time, a year, as I say, this year you write your novel, you will teach yourself mm-hmm. what it is for you to write a novel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Walter Mosley. His new book is This Year You Write Your Novel, published by Little Brown. How did you arrive at your voice? Your voice is so distinctive. You have the thumbprint that if your book was in amongst many and your name wasn't on it, I would know it was you.
You know, that's an interesting question, and it's not one that I can answer outside of the way I've already kind of tried to answer it in that book. Meaning to say that I think that I agree that, you know, I and many people have distinctive voices in their writing, and you develop that by working with it. By working, you know, and by continually working with it. You know, it's something that I see, but I can't really explain. And, but, you know, I don't think it needs explaining. I mean, it would be nice if I could, you know, this is how you find your voice. But, you know, you find your voice by doing the work, and you may not know how to control that voice, and maybe it's even better that you don't know that.
Hmm.
It's better that you know that you know, you sit there and you say, well, how did you do this? And you go, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I sat down every day and I was writing, and that sounded right. You know, that kind of the part in the book where I suggest when you're writing the book and it doesn't seem to be going forward, to read it out loud into a tape recorder.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you do when you read that is you hear your voice. You know it, but you still might not be able to define it.
Mm-hmm.
Other than by working.
So when you started writing, it didn't sound like this. Your work didn't sound as it does now. Did you work up to it?
I don't know. You know, because I wasn't. You know, I wasn't keeping tabs on it. I can't answer the question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was writing and having a really good time writing, and there were the way the music of the language, what I was saying, I was really enjoying, and that might mean that I had developed this voice, but you know, it was just so much fun that. I can't really kind of go beyond.
Sure. Well, one thing, actually, I'm flipping through it here and remembering when I read this in the book about you and poetry. And when I read that, you know, that you feel poetry is very important, as I do, but that you studied poetry. And for me, that's when it clicked in that, of course, because your writing is very poetic. Your mysteries are very poetic.
Uh-huh.
And it seems that one thing writers miss, well, a lot of writers miss, is that the importance of poetry, of reading, at least reading it, even if you have no intention of ever writing it.
I understanding poetry. And it's not only that I've read a lot of poetry, but also I studied writing poetry. I'm a really bad poet, really bad. But I studied with who I think was one of America's greatest poets. He died, mm-hmm. a guy named Bill Matthews. And William Matthews, and he was a wonderful, wonderful poet. As I said, great poet. But beyond that, he was a wonderful teacher. And I learned a great deal from him. And, you know, there's so much in poetry. I mean, really technical things. I mean, not only just the beauty of, you know, the sound of the language, just technical things, you know, which word to use, how do you use rhyme, how do you use form, how do you edit a line or a sentence until it says exactly what you say, no more and no less. You know, that is, it's just wonderful. I mean, the talent that poets have. You know, there are things in fiction that aren't, you know, that aren't poetry. But it, once you know what poetry can do, then you've really, you've gone a great distance in understanding what you can do in prose.
Hmm. What about, well, The Pedestrian in Fiction, that was an interesting little section, talking about how details, important details, are pedestrian.
Many things. I think that every, there are two things that people look for in fiction. They look for themselves, and they look for transcendence. And you have to have both things. First, you have to find characters that you identify with and that you feel and that you understand in some way, in some personal way. And once you get to that point, you understand what it's like, you know, for this guy to go to work every day and to, you know, slave with this hammer, you know, crashing against this wall. Then you can understand taking that character to another place, leaving work, for instance, coming home to see his children and understanding that all of this hard work was for something else, and that something else was, or maybe was, not worth it. And I think that the whole notion of understanding who somebody is, how their life is, in a way that I understand my own life, is so important. And of course, a lot of writers, you know, are they understand the moment of transcendence, but they don't understand how closely connected that is with the pedestrian, with the everyday.
This is a little book, but it's really a profound book. It's wonderful. We're talking about This Year You Write Your Novel by Walter Mosley, and he's with us for a little bit longer here. How about choosing whether you write in first person or third person?
Well, you know, the thing is that the most important thing you have to know is that you need to decide who's talking, who's telling the story, and it can't be the writer. It's not a piece of nonfiction. It's a piece of fiction. So everything about the novel is fiction, including the narrative voice. Once you understand that it's not going to be you telling it and you coming in to, you know, kind of control who people are, what they are, but more kind of an organic growth in it that comes from the storytelling itself. And you have to figure out, well, who's telling the story? And, you know, this comes from a lot of different things. It could be a first person. It could be third person. It could be that universal narrator, the omnipotent narrator. I think that, you know, first-time writers should tend away from the omnipotent narrator because it's so powerful that it might rob the possibility for drama in your fiction. First person, I think, is very, very difficult, though some people need it. And third person is, I think, the easiest way for a first-time writer to get into fiction. A third person, basically, you know, the way I kind of define it, it's a kind of an intelligent eye that sits on the shoulder of one or more characters in the story. Mm-hmm. And that it's intelligent, but it's not emotional. So it gives kind of objective information and some insights into the character whose shoulder it's sitting on, but not enough for it to be like a first-person power. And, you know, you decide. Like, you know, for instance, when I wrote my Socrates stories, you would think that it would be a first-person narrative because it's about really the ideas, the opinions, and the internal changes of one character. But I realized, you know, when almost immediately upon writing it, is that this character is not a very verbal one, and that the first-person narrator wouldn't work well for him. So I used the third person, even though the only shoulder that the narrator ever sits on is the shoulder of Socrates.
Interesting. What about outlining? What's your opinion of outlining?
Well, you know, I mean, outlining is a perfectly fine thing for people to do. One of the things that I tried to do in this book is to talk about what I think are the two kinds of writers. There's the structured writer, a writer who needs structure and who has structure, and then there's the unstructured writer. The structured writer usually has a story that they want to tell. They know what happens in that story, at least they think they do. And what they need to do is they said, listen, I had an aunt. She came from Romania. She came to America. She wanted to be a nun, but instead she became, a madam in a whorehouse. But she became, as that whorehouse madam, she became a great figure who helped many people in almost the same way that a nun did. You know, you have the story in your head, and you know all about her, and your mother told you about her, and you once met her, and so you're going to tell her story. Well, it might be worthwhile for that to be outlined first, because you think you know what you want to say, but maybe you haven't really thought it all out. You need to work it out, and you need to put it in a place for you to be able to start to create that story. It may be that it doesn't remain the same story that you thought it would be, or it isn't the story you thought at all. That doesn't really matter. That's okay, because you had an outline and you followed it and you ended up going someplace else. The unstructured writer, on the other hand, is somebody who just loves writing, loves language. They want to talk, and so they come up with maybe they hear a snippet of a story about a guy who was cheating on his wife, but she always loved him and took care of him anyway. And you think of some kind of story coming out of that. So you just start to write about that, and you find out where it goes. Either way is fine, because at the end of the year you should have a novel, no matter what you were thinking in the beginning.
Now, how many pages are you thinking? What's a good length for a novel?
Well, I mean, a suitable boy is what? How many thousands of pages is a suitable boy? I don't know. That's a good length for a novel. And The Stranger by Albert Camus, I think it's about 120 or 130 mm-hmm. pages. That's a good length for a novel, too. The novel I'm talking about in this is a short novel.
Mm-hmm.
In my book, I'm thinking that the first novel you're going to write, if you're going to write it in a year, it's going to be, 60,000 words, let's say, 50, 60,000, no more than that.
Mm-hmm. We have a few minutes left with Walter Mosley. He wrote, "This Year You Write Your Novel," published by Little Brown. How about rejection? Talk a minute about rejection, because it's one of those things that especially new writers, I think, really fear and believe that once you start getting published, there will be no more rejection. If only they could start getting published.
Well, you really kind of, if you're going to be a writer, you kind of have to love rejection. Not as much as if you were an actor, but almost. People are not going to like your work. I always look at it like this. I always tell people when they ask me, they say, I wish I was as successful as, so-and-so. Let's say so-and-so sells a million novels. A million books. And I said, that's a million books. That's an awful lot of books. That's a runaway bestseller. But there's 350 million people in America. That means only one out of every 350 people bought that book.
Mm-hmm.
So the other 349 people, maybe 200 people, hate the book. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, who likes your writing is going to always be a very small group of people. And so when you send out to editors, to publishers, to magazines, you're going to get rejected, and you're going to get rejected a lot, I've written a couple of stories recently, and I sent them to that major publication, the New Yorker. And I just, every story I've sent to them, for the last 5 years, they've rejected. They said, one time they said, "This isn't really a story," which I find out funny. One time they said, "You weren't really having fun, you wanted to have fun." This is what editors say. I can't say you're wrong. Well, I can say you're wrong. I think the first thing really was a story, though obviously they couldn't see it. But the second one, they didn't like either one. Here I am. I've published 28 books, I think. And translated into 23 languages. A lot of people have read my books, thought that they were interesting, but many more that have liked them don't like them. Aren't interested in them. So would look at them and read a page or two and walk away. I've sat in book, and when you do go do signing, sometimes I sit there and people walk up and they pick up a book and they look and they turn a couple of pages and they put it down and they walk away. That's a rejection of sorts. But it's nothing to worry about. That's part of life. You're entering a dialogue. You're not becoming the last word. You're just, you know, one voice among millions of voices.
When did you know you were a writer?
Hmm?
When did you know you were a writer?
When did I know I was a writer?
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting thing. It kind of fits in with your story. I had written a story for a magazine called Callaloo. I'd sent them the story, and they said they were going to publish it. And then they published it. You know, they accepted the story. It was called Voodoo, and they published it. And I was a writer. And I felt really wonderful. And then about maybe a year later, I received a letter from Callaloo. And I guess the manuscript of my story had kind of hung around there. And somebody had picked it up and thought it was, that somebody was sending this in to see if it could get published. And they read it, and they said, oh, no, it's not really for us. They actually sent me a rejection letter for a story they had already published. And so I knew I was a writer, and then I kind of felt it was taken away from me. But that was fun. I really, this book is about writing. It's not about publishing.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think the great joy that I get in writing is not, I like being published and, I like making money writing and stuff like that. But the great joy I get is from writing itself, not from anything else, really.
Right.
It's the writing itself. And this book is about the writing. This book is about, if you want to write a novel, this is how you do it. It's not, how you become famous, how you become great, how you get to a place that you never get rejected again. It's not about any of those things. It's just about writing and being happy with the writing that you do.
Hmm. And again, the writing, you learn from the writing of this book of yours here. I mean, you're teaching through your words, but also just, absorbing the words and how you put sentences together as a lesson. So thank you so much for writing it.
Oh, well, thank you. And thanks for having me on. Let me talk about it a little bit.
You're so
I'm very
welcome.
Happy with this book. So, and it's like, it's rare that I have, I'm happy in an unqualified sense about a book, but I feel like it does do what it promises, which it's a big thing, I really believe that if somebody read my book, that they would have the tools to teach themselves how to write a novel, which is, to me, one of the most important things in the world.
I do too. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Walter Mosley talking to us from New York. And again, this book, This Year You Write Your Novel, published by Little Brown, really. If you're interested in writing novels, if you're working on a novel, if you've written the first draft of a novel, check it out. I have read through this book twice. I'm in the rewrite of my novel, and I just love it. I love the writing. I love the structure. I love the shortness. And it's orange, and I love that too. We're going to take a short break, and when we get back, we will be with Kirk Snyder, who wrote The G-Quotient. Sorry, if I could only speak well at this moment, we'd all be great. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with Kirk Snyder.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Well, darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Okay. The politics of food. That was good. Same way to Thursday. Okay. Thursday mornings, 9 to 10. Radio for your belly. Okay. Radio for your belly. Yeah. But you're talking in the background. Radio for your belly.
That's nice. Yeah.
I think that's nice.
That's good. Yeah.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. At the top of the hour, we had Walter Mosley, and we are here with Kirk Snyder. But before we bring him on, let me say that if you want to hear this show, or at least refer people to this show, it'll be podcasts in a couple of weeks, most likely, as are 120, 130 shows. Go to penonfire.com, and there you can find all of the podcasts, all of the archive shows. You just click on the radio page and follow instructions. Okay, I want to introduce Kirk Snyder, who is here in the studio with me. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
At the University of Southern California, Kirk teaches business communication in both the undergraduate and graduate programs. In addition, he speaks nationally on the subject of business leadership and gay workplace issues, and his work has generated attention from publications including Time Magazine, Fast Company, Fortune, Details, Strategy and Business, The New York Times, Chicago Tribune. How long is this list, Kirk?
Oh, that's enough. My gosh.
His debut book in 2003, Lavender Road to Success, was honored by Amazon as one of the best books of the year as a top 10 editor's pick. And he's here today to talk about a new business leadership book, The G Quotient, published by Jossie Bass Wiley. Let's talk about this. Talk about The G Quotient. Let me read the subtitle, Why Gay Executives Are Excelling as Leaders and What Every Manager Needs to Know. How did this come about?
Well, actually, it came about quite by accident. It wasn't the book that I set out to write, which I think is such a good lesson for all writers to learn, even when you're writing nonfiction, sort of let the discovery process take a life of its own and let the material sort of tell you where you should go. But what I started to do, you know, with the wonders of technology was to sort data in different ways. And what I started to see was that the gay executives, gay managers all around the country, kept thinking that, gosh, all of my employees are much happier than everybody else's employees. And, you know, I was thinking originally, well, that's nice. We all think we're great. But I thought the only way to find out was to talk to the source, which was their mostly straight employees. So ultimately, one part of the research, I went and talked to over 1,000 mostly straight employees of these guys all around the country, and found that they were having a completely different experience in terms of morale, satisfaction, job engagement than what people are experiencing nationally.
So the book didn't begin so much as a book as with the research and your findings.
For my particular type of writing, which is more business career oriented, I base it on research. And how I decide what I want to do is pretty much what's interesting to me. And so I go out and do my own thing, collect all the information, and then kind of pull it together and see how things connect. And in this one, I started again to write a book about leadership because I wanted to find out for my students what was the next type of leadership that needed to be exhibited, which ultimately is what this book is about. And I sort of got led down another path.
So then you had the idea of that this all this information needed to go into a book. Then what?
Right. I realized that it needed to go into a book. And throughout this process, I was fortunate for my first book to meet a great agent, Felicia Eth, up in San Francisco. Oh, yeah. And when this data started to come up in this very unique way, we were talking about it, and she got very excited about it and said, I think that might be the next book. And
so she was your agent for the first book?
Yes. She was my agent for the first book, Lavender Road to Success. And we have a great relationship, and that's so important. I couldn't have done any of this without her. She is an amazing editor. She guides me. She tells me when I'm wrong. She tells me when I'm right. And so
happy with your agent. That's good.
I am. I couldn't be happier.
So what makes a good agent? Why are you happy with her?
She is a good agent because she believes in my talent. And she appreciates sort of the unique, I think, bent that I bring to business publishing. Sure. So that's one thing. Mm-hmm. The other is she's always right on. Sometimes I go down a road and I think something's great and, you know, go crazy. And then she'll say, you might love it, but nobody else is going to love it. And she's always right. So I think, you know, you got to let your ego kind of check at the door so you can be open to that kind of feedback.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you had her for the first book, and then you started talking to her about, you know, was it, I have this idea, what do you think? And I found this, and
Absolutely. And so what she did was, once we sort of honed in on what this next book was going to be about based on what I had uncovered in my research, she, you know, worked with me and we put the proposal together. Just like the first time I had put the proposal together before we met, before her and I met. And so she, after I signed with her, helped me massage the first one in a little bit different way. But she really worked with me on this proposal to get it ready to go to the marketplace. And in the meantime, she was laying her groundwork and talking to folks, and that helped us a little bit in putting it together. And she went out to market, and within a week, we had 3 offers.
Mm. How nice.
So, but that was all because of her, and that we had kind of worked together on this process. So, but yeah, that's so key. It's so key. I couldn't have done it without her.
Mm. I'm with Kirk Snyder, author of The G Quotient, published by Wiley. Well, that's a Jussie Bass, an imprint of Wiley, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Absolutely.
There's not these imprints anymore.
There are. I don't
there's
know
like
who,
a million
you know, there's probably one big giant publisher out there. But they were great, too. I had a wonderful experience. My first time was with 10 Speed Press, which they publish. My first book was a career book, and they publish, you know, the career Bible, which is What Color Is Your Parachute, and interesting cookbooks. So very eclectic. But I had a great editor. You know, I know writers who have had very negative experience with their editors.
Right.
But both times, both women, I might add. So I don't know if that's something, you know, that I need to look for, but it was, that was great too, to be able to take their feedback. And, you know, ultimately my idea turns out in the end to be very different than what I originally thought it was going to be.
Well, talk about the structure here, because it's broken down into parts. And the first part is 7 principles of G quotient leadership.
Right. When you take a look at this book, it's interesting because my proposal was very different in terms of the order. I was sort of thinking in a very linear way, I'm going to lay the groundwork, talk about the research, and then get into the 7 principles of leadership. And then they said, gosh, you need to hit people with that right away, because people are going to pick up a book called The G Quotient. They're going to want to know what the heck that is about. Mm-hmm. So we changed the order, which I think ultimately helped a lot. And we added a preface to sort of set it up so that people would know the reason these employees are having such a better experience isn't because their boss is gay. It had absolutely nothing to do with it in the end. It was based on these seven leadership principles that are called the G quotient.
Right.
It's just that gay men, for a variety of cultural reasons, are more predisposed to this type of management than other people.
Well, reasons.
Reason, worldview. And I tell a story in the book about the people mover sidewalks at the airport, which I think are very telling in this. And that experience, if you've ever been on there, you know, you don't have to think about where you're going. You're reading a book. You can get dressed, for God's sake, you know, on the people mover sidewalks. But if you're in the middle, you are looking at the world in different ways. And I was dodging and weaving around floor installations, and there's golf carts coming at me, you know. And so I kind of took a look around and I said, oh my God, those are straight people on those sidewalks. They're not having to think about where they're going. Not that there's not obstacles, but there's marriage and children and all of that. So when you live in the world in that center aisle, you have a different way of being. And when you get into a management role, that way of being manifests in these seven principles, which are the G quotient.
And so talk about the title, too.
It's really
kind of a catchy title.
It is a catchy title. And the book has that great big orange G on the cover. And we debated and we played with many different titles. And there was, you know, a bit of hesitation about having the word gay and G. Mm-hmm. And, of course, G stands for gay. And if you're doing research, you always, you know, name whatever it is you've discovered or identified after sort of the people who led you to that discovery. But it was, I was so supported in calling it this because ultimately, and we had marketing people and publicity people and everybody was in and my editor on the decision. And my editor called me one day and she said, we have to call it this because anything else is not doing justice to what the research is and not what it's about. So if we put some people off because of the title, so be it. And I thought, wow, I'm lucky to have these folks, you know, behind me.
Yeah, yeah. The seven principles. What is that famous book, The Seven Habits of...
Oh, of highly successful people.
Yeah. Was there any connection with that, or is it this magical number seven? Because seven
is
such a kind of magical number.
It is. Five and seven in publishing. And what was funny, I was taking a look at all of this, and I was originally thinking, gosh, 10 would be great. And I was struggling trying to come up with the other eight, because what I do is take... I do a lot of qualitative research. I do the quantitative, but then I also do the interviews and, you know, sort of read between the lines, which I think is one of my talents as a writer, and to ferret that out and connect it. And when I synthesized through all of those interviews, these were really the seven that kept coming through about why they like going to work. And I was trying to stretch it and find other things. And so ultimately, it just, you know, really, honest to God, was seven. But then my publisher said, this is great because seven and five are, you know, the magic numbers in publishing.
Well, I didn't know in publishing. I mean, those numbers are somehow powerful, but I didn't realize that someone in publishing said this about publishing.
Because if you go and look in business books, in a lot of business books, the five principles, the seven principles, the five this, seven that, it's so true.
Interesting. Wow. Okay. Okay. So you did a proposal.
Did the proposal. And this time it was very different because, like I said, I had my agent working with me. The first time I did it all in a vacuum based on what I thought would be appropriate and what was good. And that first time, you know what? I bought a book that said how to write a book proposal. And I followed it and put that together and kind of just blindly, you know, went out with query letters to agents. So, I mean, I would really tell people, you don't have to know someone. I knew no one in the industry. And I thought I had an original idea. Other people thought I did, it turns out, and went out and did it. And, you know, yeah, I got rejection letters, but I also got several. I wound up with three agents to pick from.
So you started with your first book with a query letter to agents.
Absolutely.
Yeah, great.
And I did have the proposal ready to go. So if they said, you know, well, let me see, this sounds a little interesting.
You didn't have to say, I'll get it to you in a year.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I was ready to go with that.
Okay, so then, so your first book is published. You keep the agent. The agent's good. You come to your second book, a proposal again to sell this book.
Right.
The book sells. Then what? Talk about writing the book and how you structured your days, how you put the whole thing together. Did you have a period of time where you really had to get it done?
I become obsessed. That's how I do it. I don't structure out a time. For me, I'm going to write between 5 and 7. I'm going to do this. I just become so obsessed that I, you know, am writing in the middle of the night if that's when it hits me. And I'm someone that gets more creative as the day goes on. So a lot of times I'll stay up very late when I'm in the writing process. But I think you have to become obsessed with your product and what you're doing. Because when you are, then every thought that you have practically is somehow related to the book.
Right.
Whether you're, you know, washing dishes or going to, you know, In-N-Out Burger. Mm-hmm. Whatever you're doing, you're thinking about how it relates to the book. And I think that obsession, if you will, leads to a better product.
We have a few minutes left with Kirk Snyder, author of The G Quotient, published by Wiley. So talk a little bit more about the obsession, because I think that's the one thing that is hard for writers to get behind, the idea that maybe they have to give up on some of the things that they enjoy doing if it means having more time to write, especially if someone, say, is working or, you know, has their time eaten up by other obligations.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's the price that writers ultimately have to pay. Whether it's a book, whether you're a screenwriter, whatever it is, you can't do everything. So to fulfill your need to write, you will have to sacrifice time with your family. You'll have to sacrifice, you know, doing the things that give you pleasure, although I think this will ultimately give,
right,
you know, a lot
ultimately
more pleasure. But it's very much about, you know, making a decision, a conscious decision that this is the most important thing in my life right now, and following through.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's sort of like if you talk to actors and they'll say, I had no choice, I had to do this.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of the same thing. I think I've got to do it. I had to write this book,
right,
and I'm in the process of starting research for another one, and it's going to be the same thing, and I'm getting so focused on it already and obsessed about it and thinking about it every waking moment, and you just have to let yourself, I almost would stop myself and say, okay, you're getting too obsessed. You're going down this road too much.
You're going to a movie.
Yes, you're going to a bad place. But, you know, you have to let yourself go to that bad place in order to get the work done.
Right.
And finally say, okay, it is all right. And it's just my life for this portion of time.
Now, you said you have another idea. You're working on research for another book. At what point does that next idea come? Is the second book or whatever project you're totally involved in, is that still going on until it's published and out there for a while before a new idea happens? Or were you germinating something else while you were writing this one? How does that work for you?
This idea, I'm actually working on two simultaneously this summer. And one came to me while I was writing this book, and the other one came to me afterwards. It was through an event at the university.
Mm-hmm.
So very different than this, very mainstream communication book. But it's, there's always a thread, and it's so interesting to see how your previous work, I think whether you're writing a fiction story, whether it's nonfiction, whether it's research-based, there's always going to be some value that you're bringing forward. Never think that work that you're doing that's been edited out, that you have to throw away, that you have to give up, you're going to use it at some time.
Mm-hmm.
You absolutely are. So I think
keep it somewhere.
Yes, okay. Keep it somewhere. And even if it's just an idea, you're going to bring it forward.
Mm-hmm. Did your agent or editor ever talk to you about platform? Said, well, you teach at USC. This is a very wonderful thing for your platform. Or encourage you to do more to get out there so that people would know who you were?
Absolutely. This time more, I had more time as full-time faculty with this book. I was an administrator and teaching at the same time. I did the other book. So they've both said, my agent and publisher, you need to get out there and you need to speak. And so I've really cultivated that and been doing a lot of corporate speaking. And this book, I was fortunate enough to get enough of a profile that companies are calling me to come and speak with them. So every time they're buying the book, you have to become a marketer.
Right.
You know, you have to do it all. And that's something I didn't do the first time. And I really learned the second time that you're always selling in some way.
And something a bookseller said to me who does book consulting is, because I think my book had been out for a year or so, and I'm thinking, do I keep promoting it? What do I do? And he said, as long as somebody hasn't heard of your book, it's a new book.
That's great advice.
You know, The Great Gatsby is still being read by teenagers in high school and college students. It's a new book.
Absolutely.
Doesn't matter that it was out. It's been out for decades.
Absolutely.
And that's a really, I found that sort of profound. Oh, okay. Look at it that way instead of, oh, my book's been out a year.
And I think that's where we typically think. It's the newness that, you know, is going to bring excitement. And that's not necessarily true. And I think the other thing that I'm doing, I'm writing in other places. I'm blogging all the time on Huffington Post. Arianna Huffington was nice enough to give me one of those featured blog spots.
Oh, that's great.
I write a column.
How do we find that?
Just go to HuffingtonPost.com, type in Kirk Snyder, and it'll take you to all of my articles. And I'm writing a column for PlanetOutGay.com every month called At Work with Kirk. So think about how your topic can be of interest in different types of, whether it's magazines, whether it's online, whether it's whatever venue, to keep your name out there. Because I notice a spike every month when my column comes out, my book sales spike. The same thing when I'm on Huffington Post or I write for any other publication, or I'm interviewed for another publication. It's directly related to book sales. So think about writing in other types of markets.
Right. We have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you, as well as I ask everybody about rewriting and revision, and what's your approach? Do you do interesting, weird things like, okay, it's time to rewrite, I'm going to go to...
Yes.
You know,
I go to a little cafe down, we're in Orange County, down in Corona Del Mar, and I sit with my hot chocolate by the window, and I have my printout in my little pen, and I go through and rewrite. I actually should have been an editor, because I love that process.
I love it too.
I love it. That's where the richness and the beauty comes out. I have to see it. I can't look at it on the computer screen. I actually have to hold it in my hand and look at it and write and doodle on it. But yeah, I have my little ritual, and I think that's important. Whatever it is that you do that makes you feel good and creative and it's quiet and it works for you, but to take that and live with it and be with it and see what needs to be done and be open to it.
Any advice for the writers who are listening who may be dealing with an idea that they believe should be a book proposal, but they can't quite get to the proposal, or maybe they've started a book proposal and they're laboring their way through that?
First, start with something that you're passionate about. If you're only lukewarm about a subject, it's not going to work. You've got to totally believe it. That's where the credibility comes in. And then don't be afraid. It is so scary to put yourself out there and open yourself up to rejection. But I think if you have that passion about what you're doing is important, and that even if it's going to matter, I was listening to your first guest, and he was so right, you know, there may be one person out of 350 that is going to love your book, and maybe the other 349 are going to hate it. You've got to focus on those people that your work is going to make a difference in their lives. And I just gave your book, Pen on Fire, to a friend of mine recently, and she called me basically in tears how meaningful that was to her. So when you think about, you are going to make a difference, and hold on to that, and don't be afraid of the people that are going to say, oh, this is a bad idea, because those there are going to be people that say, gosh, this is a great idea. And believe enough in yourself to do it.
Well, you very much embody, I think, your teachings, because you are so upbeat and positive and just, You know?
Oh, thank you.
Just light around you.
Oh, thank you.
So,
you're so nice.
It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Oh,
on the
thank
air.
You so much for being for having me on.
You're welcome. I've been talking with Kirk Snyder. His book is The G Quotient: Why Gay Executives Are Excelling as Leaders and What Every Manager Needs to Know, published by Wiley. We're at the end of our time again, yet again. So I want to leave you with a quote by Joseph Heller, who said, "Every writer I know has trouble writing." Thanks for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, author of Pen on Fire. I will see you next time.